The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro. Part 2, continued on cassette number 2, side 1. But little help came from the government. When its legislative branch, which had in December 1931 turned a deaf ear to suggestions that it forego its usual 2-week holiday, returned in January, it was to begin 7 months of wrangling and delay, enlivened only by congressmen's near panic when they encountered bonus marchers. Some congressmen broke into a run when the ragged men approached. When Congress finally adjourned in July 1932, the only substantial aid that had been given to farmers was a $125 million increase in the capital available for federal mortgages, an increase so far below the amount needed as to be all but meaningless, particularly since it was not accompanied, despite the pleas of farm organizations, by even a token easing in the onerous interest and repayment schedules. Despite the urgency of witnesses' pleas for help with relief funding, the congressmen who had heard those pleas squabbled over minor details for weeks that turned into months. And the provisions of the bill that finally passed were so niggardly that the average relief stipend for a family of four would be 50 cents per day. As for the vital tax and tariff reform bill, special interest blocs squabbled over its provisions, and states traded tariff proposals back and forth, until in May one senator was moved to shout, "Have we gone mad? Have we no idea that if we carry this period of unrest from 1 week to another, a panic will break loose, which all the tariffs under heaven will not stem? Yet we sit here to take care of some little interest in this state or that. My state, my state. My God, let's hear my country. What good is your state if your country sinks into the quagmire of ruin?" For months, the Forum magazine said, "The country has been looking on with something like anguish at the spectacle of the inability of the national legislature in a time of desperate need to take any action, good, bad, or indifferent, for dealing with the crucial problem of national finance." A columnist, more succinct, called the House of Representatives the Monkey House, and his sentiment was echoed by some of the congressmen themselves, declared McDuffie of Alabama, "Representative government is dead." As for the leader of the government's executive branch, when the bonus marchers begged Herbert Hoover to receive a delegation of their leaders, he sent word that he was too busy. Reinforced police patrols surrounded the White House. Barricades were erected to close nearby streets to traffic. A New York Daily News headline proclaimed, "Hoover locks self in White House." And in July, the president had the army, with fixed bayonets and tear gas, drive the veterans out of Washington. He handled the Depression with equal firmness. In December 1929, he had said, "Conditions are fundamentally sound." In March 1930, he said the worst would be over in 60 days. In May, he predicted that the economy would be back to normal in the autumn. In June, in the midst of still another market plunge, he told a delegation which called at the White House to plead for a public works project, "Gentlemen, you have come 60 days too late. The Depression is over." In his December 2, 1930 message to Congress, he said that the fundamental strength of the economy is unimpaired. Asked why, then, so many unemployed men were selling apples on street corners, he said, "Many people have left their jobs for the more profitable one of selling apples." His secretary noted that the president was beginning to regard some criticism as unpatriotic. In 1932, his tune had not changed. In April of that year, a visitor was authorized to report that conditions are getting better. The president was in high spirits over the economic improvement. When delegations came to the White House begging him to endorse direct federal aid for relief or increased spending on public works, he refused. "As long as I sit at this desk, they won't get by," he said. He couldn't bear to watch suffering, so he never visited a bread line or a relief station. As his limousine swept past men selling apples on street corners, he never turned his head to look at them. Even Time magazine, after more than 2 years of maintaining a facade almost as cheery as Hoover's, noted in 1932 that the nation's needy have gone through 3 hard winters without a dollar's worth of direct aid from the federal treasury. Said Hoover, "Nobody is actually starving. The hobos, for example, are better fed than they have ever been. One hobo in New York got 10 meals in one day." He wasn't starving. Having decided that economy in the president's kitchen would be bad for the country's morale, he continued eating at the most elaborate table ever set in the White House. Even when the only other diner was his wife, Lou, dinners were always 7 courses. While Hoover, dressed always in black tie, ate his way through them, the dress blues of the Marine duty officers in the doorways provided ceremonial trappings, and butlers and footmen, all of them the same height, stood as rigid as statues, absolutely silent, forbidden to move, unbidden. When, after months of haggling, Congress finally passed a public works bill, the President called it an unexampled raid on the public treasury, and warned, "We cannot squander ourselves into prosperity." When Congress attempted to add to his request for $25 million for the relief of animals in southern drought regions, another $35 million so that humans, as well as livestock, might be fed, he refused to allow the measure, saying, "Prosperity cannot be restored by raids on the public treasury." When finally he became convinced that some government action was necessary, the action he selected was the creation of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which critics called a breadline for big business because of its emphasis on bailing out corporations, railroads, insurance companies, and banks. Big banks, in general, it would not help smaller institutions. The RFC's attitude toward suffering on a human scale was revealed when Congress in 1932 pushed through, against the administration's wishes, an act authorizing the agency to advance the states $300 million for relief. It deliberately dragged its feet so that the states actually received only $30 million. Exactly one-third of the amount the RFC's president had loaned his own bank. "Herbert Hoover," said Breckinridge Long, "has set his face like flint against the American government's giving 1 cent to starving Americans." And when, in the autumn of 1932, Hoover went to the country to campaign for another term, crossing states he had never visited since he had been elected 4 years before, the reception that greeted him was one that had been afforded no previous American president, not even Lincoln in Richmond in the last days of the Civil War. As the president's train was pulling into Detroit, the men on it heard a hoarse, rhythmic chant rising from thousands of throats. For a moment they had hopes of an enthusiastic reception, and then they made out the words of the chant, "Hang Hoover, hang Hoover, hang Hoover." Mounted police charged the crowd, and the Secret Service hustled the president into a limousine for the 4-mile drive to Olympic Stadium. And as the presidential caravan sped past, those inside his limousine saw, through its thick windows, that the route was lined, block after block, with tens of thousands of men and women who were, in Gene Smith's words, utterly silent and grim, save for those who could be glimpsed shaking their fists and shouting unheard words and phrases. When in St. Paul, the president defended his treatment of the bonus marchers, saying, "Thank God we still have a government in Washington that still knows how to deal with a mob." The crowd responded with one vast snarl, a snarl so vicious that the Secret Service chief suddenly found himself covered with sweat. As the president's train moved across his country, its people pelted the train with eggs and tomatoes. 4 years before, he had carried 40 of the 48 states. In 1932, he carried 6. Despite his rejection by the people in November 1932, Hoover was going to be president until March 1933, March which lay on the far side of the winter ahead. Although no fewer than 158 congressmen had been defeated in November, they were going to be congressmen until March. That was a winter of despair. When, on December 5th, 1932, the lame duck Congress reconvened, those of its members who had hoped that the tear gassing of the veterans had frightened the jobless away from Washington received a surprise. Crowded around the Capitol steps were more than 2,500 men, women, and children, chanting, "Feed the hungry, tax the rich." Police armed with tear gas and riot guns herded the hunger marchers into a detention camp on New York Avenue, where, denied food or water, they spent a freezing night sleeping on the pavement, taunted by their guards. Thereafter, Congress met behind a double line of rifle-carrying police who blocked the Capitol steps, and behind these bodyguards, as the weeks of the terrible winter turned into months, the Congress dawdled and wrangled as it had been dawdling and wrangling ever since the Depression began. Sullenly, it deadlocked over the scores of competing relief proposals, while spending hours and days squabbling over whether to legalize beer and what percent of it should consist of alcohol. As for the man in the White House, he spent the interregnum maneuvering to tie his successor to his discredited policies. The program of the President Reject, as Time called him, had the virtue of consistency. His State of the Union message called, as had his previous three messages, for economy in government and a balanced budget. The lone new proposal was for a sales tax that would fall hardest on those least able to afford it. With conditions worsening as rapidly as the weather, with the welfare rolls growing longer and longer, and the relief structure so long crumbling beginning to disintegrate, he continued to withhold federal help. As the people saw that their government was going to give them no leadership, there began to be heard throughout America the sound of hungry men on the march. In Columbus, Ohio, 7,000 men in ranks tramped toward the State House to establish a workers' and farmers' republic. 4,000 men occupied the Lincoln, Nebraska State House. 5,000 took over the municipal building in Seattle. In Chicago, thousands of unpaid teachers stormed the city's banks. A Communist Party rally in New York's Union Square drew an audience of 35,000. In the cities, such outbreaks, while violent, were brief. It was in America's countryside that rebellion began to flare with a flame that, while fitful, did not die out. In the countryside, among the descendants of the People's Party, among the descendants of the Alliancemen. For half a century and more, America's farmers had been asking for tariff reform, for railroad and bank regulation, for government loans, for silver remonetization, for help in fighting forces too big for them to fight. And for half a century, their government had turned to them a very deaf ear. Now, starving, they asked again, often in words that echoed those spoken in Chicago 36 years earlier, before an audience bearing silver banners that fluttered in the breeze. An Oklahoma rancher told a House subcommittee, "We will march eastward, and we will cut the East off. We will cut the East off from the West. We have got the granaries, we have the hogs, the cattle, the corn, and the East has nothing but mortgages on our places. We will show them what we can do." And this time, when their pleas were, as usual, unanswered, the House passed farm legislation, Hoover calling it wholly unworkable. His memoirs reveal that he had not taken the trouble to understand it. Let it be known that he would veto it, and it died in the Senate. Farmers reached for their pitchforks and their guns. The previous summer, under the leadership of 65-year-old Milo Reno, who had in fact been one of the early populists, Iowa farmers, singing "Let's Call a Farmer's Holiday, a Holiday Let's Hold, We'll Eat Our Wheat and Ham and Eggs, and Let Them Eat Their Gold," had refused to deliver milk to Sioux City, where distributors who bought it from them for 2 cents were selling it for 8 cents, and to enforce the strike blocked every road leading into the city with spiked telegraph poles and logs. Warned by sympathetic telephone operators of the approach of police and sheriffs, they disarmed them and threw their pistols and badges into cornfields. The movement had spread. Soon Des Moines, Council Bluffs, and Omaha were isolated. When 60 insurgents were arrested in Council Bluffs, 1,000 farmers marched on the jail and released them. That revolt had died away, but now, in the desperate interregnum winter, rebellion flickered and flared all across America's countryside. In Iowa, a mob of farmers, flourishing a rope, threatened to hang a lawyer who was about to foreclose on a farm. In Kansas, the body of a lawyer who had just completed foreclosure proceedings was found lying in a field. In Nebraska, the leaders of 200,000 debt-ridden farmers announced that if they didn't get help from the legislature, they would march on the State House and raise it, brick by brick. A judge who had signed mortgage foreclosures was dragged from his bench by black-shirted vigilantes, blindfolded, driven to a lonely crossroads, stripped and beaten. And in scores of county seats in America's farm belt, the same scene was repeated. When a foreclosed farm was to be auctioned, crowds of armed farmers would appear at the courthouse. Prospective bidders would be jostled and shoved until they left, and the farm would be bid in for a dollar or two and returned to the original owner. The respect for institutions and public authority that holds societies together was beginning to vanish. In February 1933, the country's banks began to close. Some 5,500 had already closed in the 3 years since the crash. Few of the remaining 13,000 were healthy. They had a total of $6 billion in cash to meet $41 billion in deposits. Should a wholesale run begin, they would have to cover the balance by selling securities and mortgages, which had by now declined to a fraction of their previous value. And now the run was beginning. On February 14, 1933, Governor William A. Comstock of Michigan was told that Detroit's Union Guardian Trust Company was tottering, and that if it fell, every other bank in the city would go down with it. He was asked to declare a banking moratorium throughout Michigan, and at midnight he agreed and issued a proclamation closing the state's 550 banks. With the collapse in Michigan, suddenly there were long lines of depositors withdrawing their savings in front of tellers' windows in banks all across the country. On Monday, February 20th, the Baltimore Trust Company paid out $1 million, on Tuesday, $2 million. On Friday, February 24th, it paid out in a single day more than $6 million. Governor Albert C. Ritchie closed Maryland's 200 banks. Another state had gone under. On February 26th, banks in Indianapolis and Akron announced that withdrawals would be limited to 5% of balances. By the next day, that policy had been adopted by 100 Ohio banks. In neighboring Kentucky, banks began imposing similar restrictions. By March 1st, frantic governors had declared bank holidays in 17 states. By noon on March 3rd, every bank in Kansas and Minnesota had closed, and closings had begun in North Carolina and Virginia. And in New York, opposite Grand Central Station, depositors had formed long lines to withdraw their money from the Bowery, the world's largest savings bank. In Chicago, bankers totaling their shrinking reserves realized that their institutions had paid out $350 million in 2 weeks. The nation's two great financial strongholds were at the brink of chaos. Chaos was threatening even those farm areas that had once seemed most secure, areas such as the one that Lyndon Johnson's congressman represented. Revolt was flaring down on the Gulf. As the desperate winter of 1932 finally drew near its end, farmers applied to local banks for the usual seasonal loans for seed for the spring planting, and were told that the banks had no money to lend. Soon the truth of that statement was demonstrated to them the hard way. A farmer who still had money in a bank would suddenly hear that the bank had closed. To the farmers of South Texas, it was as if the very fabric of their society was ripping apart. One of the shuttered banks was the depository of the Corpus Christi School District. With the bank's doors closed, the school doors closed. Other school districts, dependent on property tax payments, found that with tax payments so sharply down, there was no money for teachers' salaries. Many children weren't going to school anyway. They had to work off the farm, work like field hands, for a nickel an hour. The education of their children had been so important to these farmers. Now the children were no longer receiving an education. Few farmers were free now from the dread of losing their homes. In 1933, only 38% of the farmers, about one out of every three, in once prosperous Nueces County, were able to pay their taxes. Many were 3 years behind now, so penalties and interest had been piled atop the debt. The abyss that gaped before them seemed bottomless. Farmers who had lost their land the year before had been able to go on relief, so that at least their families would not starve. Now relief organizations were all but out of funds. In February, the Corpus Christi branch of the Salvation Army announced that the last of its funds would be exhausted by the end of May. Government couldn't or wouldn't help. Their local government was poor because they were poor. Their state government was dominated by what populists called the interests. In January 1933, Nueces County farmers joined farmers from all over Texas in asking the legislature for passage of a bill authorizing the issuance of bonds to raise money for relief funding. The bill was defeated. 11 bills providing for a tax moratorium were introduced in the legislature in January and February 1933 by its small group of populists. Lumping all 11 bills together for easy handling, the legislature defeated them on February 11th, although just a few days before it had been informed that without a moratorium, tens of thousands of Texas families would shortly lose their farms. Hope for assistance from the national government had long since faded. When the farmers realized that there was going to be no help from government, they decided to help themselves, even if it meant breaking the law. The first Tuesday of each month was Foreclosure Day in Corpus Christi, the day on which the foreclosed farms were auctioned off on the steps of the Nueces County Courthouse. 25 farms were scheduled for auction on Tuesday, March 7th. At a rally on February 25th, more than 1,500 grim farmers, after being told by a speaker, "I know you are here to see that the masses of the land get justness and fairness and right," vowed to be at the courthouse on March 7th, with guns. Similar vows were being taken that week in county seats all across rural America. An entire nation was going up in flames, and its government seemed paralyzed. As James McGregor Burns has written, "Crisis was in the air, but it was a strange, numbing crisis, striking suddenly in a western city and then in the south 1,000 miles away. It was worse than an invading army. It was everywhere and nowhere, for it was in the minds of men. It was fear." On March 2nd, as his train pulled into Washington, two of his sons lifted Franklin Delano Roosevelt to his feet and snapped his heavy iron braces into place so that he could stand. Resting his full weight on his sons, he swung his legs, so terribly thin under his trousers, forward in the motion, so hard for him that after only a minute of it, sweat stood out on his brow, that made people think he was walking, and came off the train in Union Station as the flashbulbs popped. And on March 4th, he jerked those crippled legs onto the high white platform that had been erected before the Capitol and told the nation that all it had to fear was fear itself. During the speech, his face had been set and grim. So grim, reported Arthur Crock, as to seem unfamiliar to those who have long known him. But when it ended, he threw back his head and suddenly he smiled his great, confident smile. First, he ended the banking crisis. Although every bank in America had closed in the early morning hours before the inaugural, most could reopen safely if only their depositors' confidence was restored. In part, their confidence was restored by legislation. The Roosevelt administration's first bill provided for the reopening of banks under Treasury Department licenses that, in effect, guaranteed their soundness. If a specific bank did not have sufficient funds, the Federal Reserve Board would lend funds against the bank's assets. But mostly their confidence was restored by his confidence. When he smiled on the crisis, it seemed to vanish. After the legislation had passed, in a single day, Franklin D. Roosevelt held on March 12th his first fireside chat. "I want to talk for a few minutes about banking," he said. "When the people find out that they can get their money, that they can get it when they want it, the phantom of fear will soon be laid. I can assure you that it is safer to keep your money in a reopened bank than under the mattress." When the banks began reopening the next morning, the long lines were gone. Depositors put back their money so quickly, in fact, that in a single day the excess of deposits over withdrawals was more than $10 million in the Federal Reserve districts alone. Then he turned to the farm crisis. That crisis was not weeks old, but decades. Except for a few periods of prosperity, such as that caused by the World War, the condition of America's farmers had been worsening steadily for more than a century. But Roosevelt turned to it not reluctantly, but with a will. On March 16th, 12 days after he had taken office, he sent farm legislation, accompanied by a special message, to Congress. The words of the message, 5 paragraphs long, were words that farmers, and their fathers and grandfathers, had been waiting all their lives to hear. "At the same time that you and I are joining in emergency action to bring order to our banks," he told Congress, "I deem it of equal importance to take other and simultaneous steps. One of these seeks to increase the purchasing power of our farmers, and at the same time greatly relieve the pressure of farm mortgages." Of equal importance to banks. For generations, farmers had been begging their government to recognize their problems as it had recognized those of institutions such as banks. They had been pleading for acknowledgement that they were as important to their government, as worthy of its help, as the institutions in which they deposited their money. Now, in a phrase, the recognition and the acknowledgement had been conferred. Embodied in the bill were concepts for which farmers had long been pleading. It made provision at last for the reduction of the surplus that was ruin. Farmers would be paid to take acreage out of production, the money for the payment to be raised by a tax on the processors and distributors and speculators who had grown rich off farmers. It made provision for parity, a synonym for justice. Said the bill's Section 2, in words some elderly populists could hardly believe they were reading, "It is hereby declared to be the policy of Congress to establish and maintain such balance between the production and consumption of agricultural commodities as will reestablish prices to farmers at a level equivalent to the purchasing power in the pre-war period. Even more significant than the specific provisions was the tone of the five paragraphs, which contrasted so strongly with the pomposity of Hoover and of Coolidge and Harding. He didn't know whether what he was going to try would work, the new president said. I tell you frankly that it is a new and untrod path. But he was going to try. I tell you with equal frankness that an unprecedented condition calls for the trial of new means. And if these means didn't work, he said, he would be the first to admit it. And then he would try something else. And 3 weeks later, there was another message. Convinced by progressives, the spiritual heirs of the People's Party, that the first bill was not sufficient, Roosevelt sent up another. I asked the Congress for specific legislation relating to the mortgage and other forms of indebtedness of the farmers of the nation, he said. The proposed legislation was revolutionary in concept. It would use federal credit agencies to drive down the high interest rates that farmers were paying by refinancing their mortgages at 4.5%, and it would give them longer to pay. The legislation was revolutionary, monumental, in scope. $2 billion would be allocated for the plan. The legislation was ingenious. Through a complicated arrangement that would ease the burden on the Treasury, banks and other mortgage holders could exchange unpaid mortgages for federal land bank bonds paying interest at 4%, an exchange the banks would be happy to make since it would guarantee them a 4% return, while at the moment they were guaranteed only possession of farmland that no one would want to buy from them. And the legislation was only just. That many thousands of farmers in all parts of the country are unable to meet indebtedness incurred when their crop prices had a very different money value is well known to all of you, Roosevelt said. The federal government should provide for the refinancing of such indebtedness so as to accomplish a more equitable readjustment of the principal of the debt, a reduction of interest rates, which in many instances are so unconscionably high as to be contrary to a sound public policy, and by a temporary readjustment of amortization, to give sufficient time to farmers to restore to them the hope of ultimate free ownership of their own land. Some of the progressives felt he still hadn't done enough. After all, the Populist Party had, in 1892, asked also for currency inflation and for remonetization of silver. Now Senators Elmer Thomas of Oklahoma and Burton K. Wheeler of Montana and others who had picked up the Populists' fallen banner and had fought as the farm bloc all through the 1920s, took up those demands again. The tall, earnest Thomas, who had campaigned for William Jennings Bryan, said, "Agriculture does not demand a 50-cent dollar or an unsound dollar, but does protest the retention of the 200-cent dollar, a dollar which fluctuates in purchasing power from 50 cents in 1920 to 200 cents in 1933, is neither sound nor an honest dollar." At first, Roosevelt balked. "Bert," he said to Wheeler, "Bryan killed the remonetization of silver in 1896. Then he compromised, accepting amendments providing for remonetization and a mild inflation. For 5 long weeks, the Senate tried to stall, but it couldn't stand before him. Said one senator from a traditionally Republican state, "We gave Franklin D. Roosevelt a 160,000 majority. We had confidence in Franklin D. Roosevelt. We still have confidence in Franklin D. Roosevelt." On May 10th, the Omnibus Farm Relief Act passed the Senate. On May 12th, the President signed it into law. For decades, while their fortunes fell and fell, farmers had been asking for the measures embodied in that Farm Relief Act, and in all those years, no action of lasting significance had been taken on their behalf. It hadn't taken Franklin D. Roosevelt 100 days to give them that action. He had needed only 69. And on May 13th, when Lyndon Johnson opened the usual letters from constituents asking for help, there was help available for him to give them. There was a desperate urgency to the task of the new Agricultural Adjustment Administration. Its mission was to reduce crops. With every passing day, more crops were being planted as spring spread north across America. The AAA was working against the sun. All the organizational problems that might be anticipated in a gigantic administrative machine created in such haste were present in the Agriculture Department's huge South Building, where clerks were struggling to reduce a nation's agriculture to millions of punched cards running over and over through automatic tabulating machines, each card representing a farmer, his farm, and his complex crop production agreements with the government. Not even in existence in April, by the end of May, the AAA had 5,000 employees. The seven-story South Building, as big as three city blocks, was a sea of desks, its miles of corridors crowded with delegations of cotton growers, wheat growers, and dairymen, with packers and processors, with farm leaders and reporters. So bitter was an ideological split at the new agency's upper levels between its traditionalist farmer agrarians and its new visionary reformers and urban lawyers that both sides, as one observer noted, were using that saddest and shabbiest of tricks employed by zealots within any organization, the trick of holding up papers or decisions at bottlenecks, or of burying them in details, or of trucking them out with such bureaucratic harness or baggage as delays or kills actions. Power struggles were also virulent because the AAA was not under civil service, and a large number of politicians had found places in it. In the daily skirmishes, bureaus were shifted from one agency to another, or abolished entirely overnight, their work parceled out among other bureaus, which might or might not be informed of their new responsibilities. The AAA was the despair, in another's words, of everyone having to do with it, a monstrous bureaucratic maze. Assistance from his congressman would have been helpful to Lyndon Johnson in finding his way through this maze, but in the spring, Dick Clayburgh spent his time at Burning Tree. Mr. Dick was not disposed to cooperate with the AAA anyway. He would, in fact, have voted against the AAA, which he called socialistic and radical, even after Johnson told him that mail from his district was running 30-1 in favor of the measure. Had not Johnson and the pragmatic Roy Miller assured him that his vote didn't matter because the bill was going to pass by an overwhelming margin. So Johnson found his own way, found it himself after he had paved it himself. Telephoning an AAA bureaucrat, he would introduce himself as Congressman Clayburgh from the Agriculture Committee, and ask the bureaucrat to give all assistance possible to his secretary, Lyndon Johnson. Not long thereafter, Secretary Johnson would show up at the bureaucrat's office. Other secretaries similarly used their congressmen's names on the telephone to gain entree, although not as brazenly or as frequently. It was almost a matter of course now for Johnson to introduce himself as Congressman Clayburgh. But what he did with that entree was not at all usual. He was smiling and deferential, Tommy Corcoran, a keen observer of the Washington scene, was to say of Johnson. But hell, lots of guys can be smiling and deferential. He had something else. No matter what someone thought, Lyndon would agree with him, would be there ahead of him, in fact. He would follow someone's mind around and figure out where it was going and beat it there. And he touched every base. Leaving a bureaucrat's office, he smiled and chatted with his assistants and his secretaries until soon he had entire bureaus, top to bottom, willing to help him. He was pushing farmers as well as bureaucrats. Confused by the complexity of the new programs and distrustful of government promises that they would actually receive money for plowing up crops, farmers all across America were hesitating to sign AAA applications and plow-up contracts. Many of the Agricultural Extension Service's county agents, whom the AAA had been counting on to educate farmers about the new programs, didn't understand the programs, and others, Republican-appointed, long in their jobs and deeply conservative, were unwilling to cooperate with socialism. Lyndon Johnson educated his district himself. Hour after hour, he sat in room 1322 telephoning his county agents. When he heard about an influential farmer who was balking, he telephoned the farmer. The nationwide progress of the cotton sign-up program was so slow in 1933, despite two appeals by Roosevelt for cooperation, that on July 11th, Secretary of Agriculture Henry Wallace was forced to announce that the program would be canceled if the sign-up rate did not double. At the time Wallace made that announcement, the sign-ups from the 14th Congressional District of Texas had already far exceeded the district's quota. Applications and plow-up contracts from other districts became stalled or lost in the South Building because the bureau to which they were addressed no longer handled them, and no one seemed to know who did. Johnson knew, and he saw to it that applications from his district were sent to the right office. After they arrived, he would show up at that office and get them moved to the top of the huge piles awaiting action. With approval from a dozen different bureaus required for each contract, contracts from other districts might be stalled for months. Johnson would show up at each bureau, and contracts from the 14th District were approved and back in the mail within days. In a White House ceremony on July 28, 1933, President Roosevelt presented the first AAA check for plowed under cotton. Its recipient was farmer William E. Morris of the 14th District's Nueces County. The cotton plow-up payments enabled South Texas farmers to make their monthly mortgage payments, but were insufficient to enable them to pay their arrears. The machinery established by Roosevelt for assistance with these arrears, the Mortgage Refinancing Federal Land Bank, was not yet in gear. Not only was refinancing more complicated than plowing up crops, refinancing required an appraisal of each individual farm. And during the first 3 weeks of September alone, 2,631 desperate Texas farmers applied for refinancing to the Federal Land Bank's Houston office, whose appraisal staff consisted of 9 men. Before the machinery could get in gear, many farms would be lost. Banks and mortgage companies, already overstocked with farms they could not sell, did not want more farms if they could instead get the money they were owed on them, but by fall they had decided they could wait no longer for it. In October, sheriffs tacked up foreclosure notices on 67 farms in the 14th District, farms for which the Roosevelt rescue operation was going to come too late. With Congress in recess, the district's congressman was home in Corpus Christi. The farmers appealed to him for help, asking for a meeting. The congressman was not disposed to grant them one, seeing no way in which he could help them, but his secretary said the meeting should be held. He had thought of a plan. Only the furnishing of new collateral would persuade the mortgage companies to wait for their money. The farmers felt they didn't have any collateral, and in the traditional sense they didn't. Their savings, even the butter and egg money, were long gone. Not only every acre of land, but every piece of machinery was already mortgaged. But Lyndon Johnson had thought of new collateral, crops that hadn't been planted yet. The farmers, he thought, should each agree to give their mortgager a landlord's share, a third, of the 1934 crop in exchange for a year's extension on the mortgage. The mortgage companies might not normally agree to this, but Johnson felt they would now if they could be given assurances that the extension would enable them to get their money, not only current interest payments, but the arrears as well. And Johnson had conceived an innovation that would give farmers enough money to pay their arrears. The richness of the black loam of the Gulf Coast had made its farmers prosperous in good times. Johnson wanted to use the richness of the soil to help them in bad times as well. He wanted the Federal Land Bank to agree to take soil productivity into account in deciding how much to lend on a farm. Such an innovation would mean considerably more money for each farmer than the Federal Land Bank had previously been willing to lend, enough money to pay the mortgage arrears. The mortgage companies would also, he knew, want assurances that they would get their money on time, within the year's extension. At the present slow pace at which the Federal Land Bank had been moving, no one could be assured of that. So he wanted the pace accelerated. He wanted the Land Bank to promise the mortgage companies that it would give priority to loan applications from the 14th District. He needed, in other words, commitments both for a new policy and for speed in implementing it. He got them. To obtain the commitments, two requirements had to be met. A Federal Land Bank official had to be persuaded to come to Corpus Christi and meet personally with the farmers. Johnson was sure that a face-to-face meeting with these desperate men could not help but win the official's sympathy. And the official had to be high enough in rank to give commitments on the Land Bank's behalf, so that his sympathy would be translated into the immediate action needed. In dealing with the Land Bank, he had a weapon available. The deputy governor of the bank's parent body, the Farm Credit Administration, was W.I. Myers, an old friend of Dick Clayburgh. Tracking down Myers, who was visiting Dallas, Johnson put Clayburgh on the phone with him, and the old friend agreed to come to Corpus Christi himself for the meeting and to bring along with him the president of the Federal Land Bank's Houston office, A.C. Williams. Then Johnson began telephoning. All day he telephoned bankers and mortgage company representatives. At night, when they were in from the fields, he telephoned farmers. And on the evening of October 27th, 67 farmers, 67 men who had given their lives to their land and then had received notices saying that the land would be taken away from them, trooped onto the broad, shady porch of Dick Clayburgh's enormous home overlooking the Gulf in Corpus Christi, to meet there with the men who had sent the notices. The largest gathering of farm credit leaders ever held in South Texas, the caller termed it, and with the two men who could provide the money to save their land. Clayburgh's tall, skinny secretary explained his proposal, and everyone accepted it. The farmers agreed to write letters to the mortgage companies promising them a third of their crop. The government promised to speed and to liberalize mortgage refinancing. And the mortgage holders agreed to accept the letters and the promises and to take down the foreclosure notices. Myers went off to the King Ranch for a few days of hunting, after first, at Johnson's discreet urging, telephoning the head of the land bank appraisal division in Houston. Within a week, all 67 farms had been appraised and refinanced. By the end of the year, federal land bank mortgages, stretching out amortization payments from 5 years to 15, and reducing interest payments from 8% to 4%, had been given to every endangered farm in South Texas. During that summer of 1933, as farmers plowed up tens of millions of acres of cotton, whipping their mules, which had been trained not to step on plants, to make them pull the plows over the cotton rows, farm prices rose to 10 cents a pound, but by autumn they were falling again. Because of bureaucratic difficulties, moreover, many farmers had not received their first AAA payments. If what he was trying didn't work, the president had promised, he would try something else. In October, he tried something else. To offset the drop in prices, he established a commodity credit corporation to lend 10 cents a pound on cotton to farmers who agreed in advance to participate in the 1934 crop production program. This shored up prices, and as winter began, the AAA and Farm Credit Administration programs began to take hold. Benefit payments, commodity loans, and mortgage refinancing contracts began to flow out to farmers. The currency expansion they had so long demanded at last took place. For American farmers, the long, desperate decades were finally over. For the first time, moreover, farmers could plan ahead without the fear that forces beyond their control made planning senseless. For the first time, they possessed a measure of meaningful control over their destiny. Beyond its immediate benefits, AAA programs gave farmers what they had thought they could never have, a kind of insurance against ill fortune. As the Corpus Christi caller put it, they can know almost to the cent how much money they will receive in benefit payments during the year, despite the vagaries of the weather. Whatever the New Deal program, Johnson reaped for his district every dollar it could provide. He urged district farmers to repay their 1933 crop reduction loans as quickly as possible, so that they could get new loans, so that, as a press release from Congressman Clayburgh's office put it, the record for this section would remain on the favorable basis established, and so that this section would be in a position to ask for consideration on any farm matters which might arise in the future. On November 19, 1933, the AAA announced that the 14th Congressional District of Texas had the best loan repayment record of any of the nation's 435 congressional districts. And in 1934, the district received the type of consideration Johnson had had in mind. It was the first congressional district to have every one of its crop production loan applications approved by the AAA. 85% of its farmers had applied for these loans, a figure that may itself have been the highest for any congressional district in the nation. The figures are unclear on this point. Most congressional offices closed during the 5 or 6 month congressional recess. During the recess, Johnson returned with Clayburgh to Corpus Christi, but kept either Latimer or Jones in Washington, so that the office of the 14th District never closed. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.